This is a tape of a story entitled Save As by Michael Marshall Smith. The story first appeared It was originally published in InterZone 115, January 1997, copyright 1997 by Michael Marshall Smith, and I'm reading it from The Mammoth Book of Best New Horror, edited by Stephen Jones, copyright 1998. The date right now is Friday, February 15th, 2002. It's about 12:45 a.m. This is the story, Save As, by Michael Marshall Smith. And I should point out that title is Save As, and it's followed by three little dots, like an ellipse. Okay, Save As by Michael Marshall Smith, read by Goblin Hood. As soon as I walked out of the hospital, I knew what I was going to do. It was 1 a.m. by then, for what little difference that made. I was on hospital time, crash time, blood time, surprised by how late it was. As if I'd believed that what happened must have taken place in some small pocket of horror outside the real world, where the normal rules of progression and chronology don't apply. Of course, it must have taken time for the men and women in white coats to run the stretcher trolleys down the corridors, shouting for crash teams and saline to cut through my wife's matted clothes and expose wet ruins where only an hour ago all had been smooth and dry, to gently move my son's head so that its position in relation to his body was the same as it had always been. All of this took time, as did the eventual slow looks up at me, the quiet shakes of the doctor's heads, the forms I had to sign, and the words I had to listen to. Then the walk from the emergency room to the outside world, my shoes tapping softly on the linoleum as I passed rows of people with bandaged fingers. That took the most time of all. The air in the car park was cool and moist, freshened by the rain. I could smell the grass which grew in the darkness beyond the lamps, pools of yellow light, and hear in the distance the sound of wet tires on the freeway. Tires which, I hoped, would retain their grip, safely transport the car's passengers to their homes. Tires which wouldn't fail under a sudden braking to avoid a car which had slewed into their path, hurtling the vehicles together. I suddenly realized that I had no means of getting home. The remains of the Lexus were presumably lying by the side of the road where the accident had taken place, or had been carted off to a wrecker's yard. For the moment, the problem took up the whole of my mind, unnaturally luminescent. And then I realized both that I could presumably call a cab from reception, and that I didn't really care. Two orderlies walked across the far side of the lot, a faint laugh carrying to me the smell of smoke in their wake. Reminded me I was a smoker, and I fumbled a cigarette from the packet in my jacket pocket. The carton was perfectly in shape, the cigarette unbent, one of the very few things Helena and I had ever argued about was my continued inability to resist toying with death in the form of tubes of rolled tobacco. Her arguments were never those of the zealot, just measured and reasonable. She loved me, and Jack loved me, and she didn't want the two of them to be left alone. The fact that the crash, which had crushed her skull, had left my cancer sticks entirely unmolested was a joke, which she would have liked and laughed at hard. For a moment I hesitated. I couldn't decide whether Helena's death meant I should smoke the cigarette or not. Then I lit it and walked back to reception. If I was going to go through with it, I didn't have much time. The cab dropped me at the corner of Montague and 31st. I overtipped the driver, who'd had to put up with a sudden crying jag, which left me feeling cold and embarrassed, and watched the car swish away down the deserted street. The crossroads was bleak and exposed. An empty used car lot and burnt-out gas station taking two corners, run-down buildings of untellable purpose, squatting kitty-corner on the others. It couldn't have been more different from the place where I'd originally gone to visit the Same Again Corporation, an altogether more gleaming street in the heart of the business district. I guessed space was cheaper out here, and maybe they needed a lot of it, though I couldn't really understand why. Data storage is pretty compact these days. Whatever, the card I'd kept in my wallet was adamant that I should go to the address on Montague in case of emergency, and so I walked quickly down towards 1176. I saw from across the street that a light was on behind the frosted glass of the door and picked up the pace with relief. It was open, just as the card said it would be. As I crossed the street, a man came out of Same Again's front door, holding a very wet towel. He twisted the towel round on itself, squeezing as much of the water out of it as he could. It joined the rain already on the sidewalk and disappeared. When he saw where I was heading, he suddenly looked up. "Help you?" he asked warily. I showed him the card. An unreadable expression crossed his face.
"Go inside," he said. "Be right with you."
The reception area was small but smart and very quiet. I waited at the desk for a few moments while the man finished whatever the hell he was doing. Then I noticed a soft dripping sound. A patch of carpet near one of the walls was damp, and there was a similar spot on the ceiling. I turned to find the man reaching out a hand to me.
"Sorry about that,"
he said, but didn't offer any more explanation.
"Okay, can I have that card?"
He took it and went behind the desk, tapped my customer number into the terminal there. "My name's," I said, but he held up his hand.
"Don't tell me," he said quickly. "Not a thing. I assume something pretty major has happened."
He looked at my face for a moment and decided he didn't have to wait for an answer.
"So it's very important that I know as little as possible. How many people have already been involved?"
"Involved?"
"And are aware of whatever event it is that has brought you here."
"I don't know." I didn't know who counted. The doctors and nurses, presumably, and the people who'd loaded up the ambulance. They'd seen the faces. Others knew something had happened, in that they'd driven past the mess on the freeway or walked past me as I stood in the parking lot of the hospital. But maybe they didn't count because they had no knowledge of who had been involved in what. Maybe 10, 12. The man nodded briskly.
"That's fine. Okay, I've processed the order. Go through that door and a technician will take you from there. May I just remind you of the terms of the contract you entered into with Same Again? Most specifically, that you are legally bound not to reveal to anyone either that you are a subscriber to our service
or that you have made use of it on this or any other occasion. Fine, I said. It was illegal, we both knew that, and I was the last person who wanted any trouble. The door led me into a cavernous, dark area where a young woman in a green lab coat waited for me. Without looking directly at my face, she indicated that I should follow her. At the end of the room was a chair, and I sat in it and waited quietly while she applied conductant gel to my temples and attached the wires. When she was finished, she asked if I was comfortable. I turned my head towards her, clamping my lips tightly together. My teeth were chattering inside my head, the muscles of my jaw and neck spasming. I could barely see her through a haze of grief I knew I could not bear. In the end, I nodded. She loaded up a hypo and injected something into the vein on the back of my hand. I started counting backwards from 20, but made it no further than 9. I got home about 4 o'clock that afternoon. After I'd locked the Lexus, I stood in the driveway for a moment, savoring a breeze which softened the heat like a ceiling fan in a noisy bar. The weathermen kept saying summer was going to burst soon, but they were evidently as full of shit as their genus had always been. Chaos theory may have grooved a lot of people's lives, but the guys who stood in front of maps for a living were obviously still at the stage of consulting entrails. It hadn't rained for weeks and didn't look like it was going to start anytime soon. And that was good because in the evening we had a bunch of friends coming round for a cookout in the backyard. I let myself into the house and went straight through into the kitchen. Helena was standing at the table basting chicken legs, half an eye on an old Tom Hanks film playing on the set in the corner. I noticed with approval that it was an old print, one which hadn't been parallaxed. Good movie, I said. Would be, she replied, if you could see what the hell was going on. I'm against the enhancing of classics. Helena takes the opposite view, as is her wont. We'd had the discussion about 100 times, and as neither of us really cared, we only put ourselves through it for fun. I kissed her on the nose and dunked a stick of celery in the barbecue sauce. Dad! Yelped a voice, and I turned in time to catch Jack as he leapt up at me. He looked like he'd been dragged through a hedge sideways by someone who was an internationally acknowledged expert in the art of interfacing humans and hedges to maximum untidying effect. I raised an eyebrow at Helena, who shrugged. How many pairs of hands do you see? She asked. I sat Jack down, endured him boxing my kneecaps for a while, and then sent him upstairs for a bath, promising I'd come up and talk to him. I knew what he really wanted was to rehearse yet again the names of the kids who'd be coming tonight. He's a sociable kid, much more than I was at his age, but I think I was looking forward to the evening as much as him. The secret of good social events is to only invite the people you like having in your life, not the ones you merely tolerate. Tonight we had my boss, who was actually my best friend, and his wife, a couple of Helena's old girlfriends who were as good a time as anyone could handle, and another old colleague of mine over from England with his family. I hung with Helena in the kitchen for a while until she tired of me nibbling samples of everything she'd painstakingly arranged on serving plates. She was too tall to box my kneecaps, and so bit me on the neck instead, a bite which turned into a kiss and became in danger of throwing her cooking schedule out of whack. She shooed me out, and I left her to it and went through into the study. There were screeds of email to be sent before I could consign the day to history and settle down into the evening and weekend. But most of it was already written, and the rest didn't take long. As my software punted them out, I rested my chin on my hands and gazed out into the yard. A trestle table was already set up, stacks of paper plates at the ready, the old cable spool we used as a table when it was just family had been rolled over by the tree, and bottles of red wine were open and breathing in the air. Beer would be frosting in the fridge, and the fixings for Becky and Janny's drink of choice, mint juleps for Christ's sake, ready and waiting in the kitchen. I could hear Helena viciously chopping some errant vegetable in the kitchen, and Jack hollering in the bath upstairs. For a moment, I felt perfectly at ease. I was 36, had a wife I'd die for, and a happy, intelligent kid. A job I actually enjoyed, and more money than we needed, and a house that looked and felt like an advert for the American way. So what if it was schmaltzy? It was what I wanted. After my 20s, a frenetic nightmare of bad relationships and shitty jobs. In my early 30s, when no one around me seemed to be able to talk about anything other than houses, marriage, or children, my life had finally found its mark. The good things were in place, but with enough perspective to let me exist in the outside world, too. I was a lucky guy, and not too stupid to realize it. The machine told me it had accomplished its task, and that I had new mail. I scanned the sender addresses, one from my sister in Europe, and a spam about outstanding business opportunities. There follows parentheses with $6 signs in it, followed by a exclamation point. I was mildly surprised to see that there was also one from my own email address entitled "Read This," but not very. As part of my constant battle to design a kill file which would weed out email invitations to business opportunities of any kind, regardless of the number of suffixed dollar signs, I was often sending out test messages to myself. Evidently, the new version of the kill file wasn't cutting it. I could tool around with it a little more on Sunday afternoon, maybe aided by a glass of JD. Right now, it hardly seemed important. I told the computer to have a nap and went upstairs to confront the dripping chaos that our bathroom would be. John and Julia arrived first, as usual. They were always invited on a turn-up-when-you-feel-like-it basis. Helena was only just out of the shower, so Julia went up to chat with her. Meanwhile, John and I stood in the kitchen with bottles of beer and chewed a variety of rags, him nibbling on Helena's cooking, me trying to rearrange things so she wouldn't notice. We moved out into the yard when Becky and Janny arrived, and I started the Weber up, supervising the coals with foremanship from Helena at the table. I'd strung a couple of extension speakers out the door from the stereo in the living room, and one of Helena's compilation mini-discs played quietly in the background. Something old, something new, something funky, and something blue. Jack sat neatly on a chair at the end of the trestle, in his new pants and checked shirt, sipping at a Diet Coke and waiting for the real fun to begin. Becky chatted with him in the meantime, while Janny re-ran horror stories of her last relationship. She's working on being the Fran Lebowitz of her generation and getting there real fast. When everyone around the table erupted, as she got to the end of yet another example of why her ex-boyfriend had not been fit to walk the earth, Helena caught my eye. and smiled. I knew what she meant. There, but for the grace of God, she was thinking, could have gone you or I. Being funny is cool. Being happy is better. I left the Coles to themselves for a bit and went and stood behind Helena with my hand on her shoulder. But then the doorbell went and she jumped up to let Howard and Carol in. Jack stood uncertainly, waiting for them to come through into the garden. Their two kids, whose names I could never remember, walked out behind them. There was a moment of quiet mutual appraisal, and then all three ran off towards the tree to play some game or other. They'd only ever met once before, on a trip we took to England, but obviously whatever they'd got up to then was still good for another day. As the evening began to darken, and the adults sat around the table and drank and ate, I could hear, always in the background, one of my favorite sounds of all, the sound of Jack laughing, and smell Helena's barbecue sauce wafting over from the grill, and feel Helena's leg, her thigh warm against my leg, her ankle hooked behind mine. At 10, I came out of the house, clutching more beers, and realized two things. The first was that I was kind of drunk. Negotiating this step down from the kitchen was a little more difficult than it should have been, and the raucous figures around the trestle table looked less than clear. I shook my head, trying to get it back together. I didn't want to appear inebriated in front of my son. Not that he was on hand to watch. The kids were still tirelessly cavorting off in the darkness of the far end of the yard. The second thing I noticed was less tangible, something to do with atmosphere. While I'd been in the kitchen, it had changed. People were still laughing, and laughing hard, but they'd moved round, were sitting in different positions at the table. I guess I'd been in the kitchen longer than I thought. Becky and Janny were huddled at one end of the table, and I perched myself on a chair nearby. But they were talking seriously about something and didn't seem to want to involve me. There was another burst of laughter from the other end, and I looked blearily towards it. There was something harsh in the sound. Helena and Carol were leaned in tight together, their faces red and shiny. Howard was chortling with John and Julia. It was good to see them getting on together, but I hadn't realized they were all so chummy. Howard had only been with the firm for a year before upping stakes and going with Carol back to her own country. John and I had been friends for 20 years. Still, I guess it showed the evening was going well. Then I saw something I couldn't understand. Helena's hand reaching out and taking a cigarette from the packet lying on the table. I frowned vaguely, knowing something wasn't right, but she stuck the cigarette in her mouth and lit it with her lighter. Then I remembered that she'd started a few months before, finally dragged into my habit. I felt guilty, wishing I'd been able to stop before she started. Too late now, I suppose. I reached for the bottle of beer I'd perched on the end of the table and missed. Well, not quite missed. I made enough contact to knock it off the table. Janny rolled her eyes and started to lean down for it, but I beat her to it. It's okay, I'm not that drunk, I said slightly stiffly. This wasn't true, of course, because it took me rather longer than it should to find the bottle. In the end, I had to completely lean over and look for where it had gone, This gave me a view of all the legs under the table, which was kind of neat. And I remained like that for a moment. Lots of shins all standing together. Some more together than others, I realized. Helena's foot was resting against John's. I straightened up abruptly, cracking my head on the end of the table. Conversation around the table stopped, and I found myself with seven pairs of eyes looking at me. "Sorry," I said, and went back into the kitchen to get another beer. A couple later, really pretty drunk by then, didn't want to sit back down at the table, felt like walking around a bit. Besides, Jenny and Becky were still in conference. Jenny looking old, Howard and Carol and Julia talking about something else. I didn't feel like butting in. Headed off towards the tree, thinking I'd see what the kids were up to. Maybe they'd play with me for a while. Better make an effort to talk properly. Didn't want Jack to see Daddy zonked. Usually it's okay as my voice stays pretty straight unless I'm completely loaded. And as I couldn't score any coke that afternoon, that wasn't the case. Coke. What the fuck was I talking about? I ground to a halt then, suddenly confused. I didn't take coke, never had. Well, once, a few years back, it had been fun but not worth the money, and an obvious, slippery slope. Too easy to take until it was all gone and then just buy some more. Plus, Helena would have gone ballistic. She didn't even like me smoking, for God's sake. Then I remembered her taking a cigarette earlier and felt cold. She hadn't started smoking. That was nonsense. So why did I think she had? I started moving again, not because I felt I'd solved anything, but because I heard a sound. It wasn't laughing. It was more like quiet tears. At the far end of the yard, I found Jack's camp, a little clearing which huddled up against the wisteria that clung to the fence. I pushed through the bushes, swearing quietly. Jack was sitting in the middle, tears rolling down his moon-like face. His check shirt was covered in dirt, the leg of his pants torn. Howard's kids were standing around him, giggling and pointing. As I lumbered towards them, the little girl hurled another clump of earth at Jack. It struck him in the face, just above the eye. For a moment, I was totally unable to move, and then I lunged forward and grabbed her arm. "Piss off, you little bastards," I hissed, yanking them away from my son. They stared up at me, faces full of some thought I couldn't read. Then the little boy pulled his arm free, and his sister did the same. They ran off laughing towards the house. I turned again to Jack, who was staring at the fence. "Come on, big guy," I said, bending down to take him in my arms. "What was that all about?" His face slowly turned to mine, and my heart sank at what was always there to see. The slight glaze in the eyes, the slackness at one corner of his mouth. "Dada," he said, "they dirt me." I fell down onto my knees beside him, wrapping my arms around his thin shoulders. I held him tight, but as always sensed his eyes looking over my shoulder, gazing off into the middle distance at something no one else could see. Eventually, I let go of him and rocked to my feet again, hand held down towards him. He took it and struggled to his feet. I led him out of the bushes and into the yard. As we came close to the tree, I saw Helena and John were approaching out of the darkness. I sensed some kind of rearrangement taking place as they saw us, but couldn't work out what it might have been.
Oh shit, what's happened now?
Helena said, reading Jack's state instantly and stepping towards us. John hung back in the deep shadows. I couldn't answer her, partly just because I was drunk. I'd obviously overcompensated for my dealer's coke famine by drinking way more than usual, but mainly because there was something wrong with her face. Not her face, which was as beautiful as ever. Her lipstick, it was smudged all around her face.
Christ, you're useless,
she snapped, and grabbed Jack's hand. I didn't watch as she hauled him back towards the house. Instead, I stared into the darkness under the tree, where a faint glow showed John was lighting a cigarette. Having a good evening? I asked. Oh yeah, he said, laughing quietly. You guys always throw such great parties. We walked back to the trestle table, neither of us saying anything. I sat down next to the girls, glanced across at Becky. She looked a lot worse than the last time we'd seen her. The chemo obviously wasn't working. How are you feeling? I asked. She looked up at me, smiled tightly.
Fine, just fine, she said.
She didn't want my sympathy, and never had, since the afternoon I'd called round at her place, looking for some company. Behind me I heard John getting up and going through into the kitchen. I'd never liked Julia nor she me, and so it would be no comfort to look round and see her eyes following her husband into the house, where Helena would already have dispatched Jack up to bed with a slap on the behind, and would maybe be standing at the sink, washing something that didn't need washing. Instead, I watched Howard and Carol talking together. They at least looked happy. I stood at the front door as the last set of taillights turned into the road and faded away. Helena stood behind me when I turned to take her hand. She smiled meaninglessly, her face hard and distant, and walked away. I lumbered into my study to turn the computer off. Instead, I found myself waking it from sleep and clicked into my mail program. I read the letter from my sister, who seemed to be doing fine. She was redecorating her new house with her new boyfriend. I nodded to myself. It was good that things were finally going her way. I turned at a sound behind me to find Helena standing there. She plonked a cup of coffee down on the desk beside me.
There you go, Mr. Man,
she said, and I smiled up at her. I didn't need the coffee because I hadn't drunk very much. Sitting close to Helena all evening was still all the intoxication I needed, but it would be nice anyway.
Good evening,
she asked, running her fingers across the back of my neck. Good evening, I said, looping my arm around her waist.
Well, don't stay down here too long,
she winked, because we could make it even better. After she'd gone, I applied myself to the screen, but before I could start writing a reply to my little sis, I heard Helena's voice again. This time it was hard, and came as usual from outside the study.
Put your fucking son to bed,
she said.
I can't deal with him tonight.
I turned, but she was already gone. I sat with my head in my hands for a little while, then reached out for the coffee. It wasn't there. Then something on the screen caught my eye, something I dismissed earlier. "Read this," it said. As much to avoid going upstairs as anything, I double-clicked on the mail icon. A long text message burped up onto the screen and I frowned. My kill file tests usually only ran a couple of lines. Blinking against the drunkenness slopping through my head, I tried to focus on the first sentence. I managed to read it in the end, and then the next. And as I read all the way through, I felt as if my chair was sinking, dropping lower and lower into the ground. The message was from me. It was about same again. And finally I remembered. Before I'd come home that afternoon, I'd driven over to their offices in the business district. It was the second time I'd been, the first when I signed up for the service and had a preliminary backup done a year before. When I'd got up this morning, awakened by Jack's cheerful chatter and feeling the warmth of Helena's buttocks against mine under the sheets, I'd suddenly realized that if there were any day on which to make a backup of my life, today was surely that day. I'd sat in the chair and they'd done their thing, archiving the current state of affairs into a data file, a file which, as their blurb promised, I could access at any time life had gone wrong, and I needed to return to the saved version. I heard a noise out in the hallway, the sound of a small person bumping into a piece of furniture. Jack. Any minute I should go out and help him, put him to bed, maybe read to him a little, see if I could get a few more words into his head. If not, just hold him a while as he slipped off into a sleep furnished with a vagueness I could never understand. All it takes is one little sequence of DNA out of place, one infinitesimal chemical reaction going wrong. That's all the difference there is between the child he was and could have been. Becky would understand that. One of her cells had misbehaved too, like a one or zero out of place in some computer program. Wet towels. Heavy rain, a leaking ceiling. Suddenly I remembered going to a dark office on Montague in the wet small hours of some future morning. The strange way the man with the towel had reacted when I said I needed to do a restore from a backup they held there. And I knew what had happened. There'd been an accident. Or there was going to be the same rain that would total the car, which for the moment still sat out in the drive, was going to corrupt the data I'd spent so much money to save. At the bottom of the mail message was a number. I called it. Same again's 24-hour switchboard was unobtainable. I listened to a recorded voice for a while and then replaced the handset. Maybe they'd gone out of business. Backing up was, after all, illegal. Too easy for criminals to leap backwards before their mistakes. For politicians to run experiments. Wide scale, it would have caused chaos. So long as not many people knew, you could get away with it. The disturbance was undetectable. But now I knew, and this disturbance was far too great. I could feel like a heavy weight, the aura of the woman lying in the bed above my head, could predict the firmness with which her back would be turned towards me, the way John and I would dance around each other at work the next day, and the endless drudgery of the phone calls required to score enough coke to make it all go away for a while. Hi, Dad, you still up? Jack stood in the doorway. He'd taken 3 apples from the kitchen and was attempting to juggle them. He couldn't quite do it yet, but I thought it wouldn't be too long now. Perhaps I would learn then, and we could do that stuff where you swap balls with one another. That might be kind of cool. Yep, I said, but not for much longer. How about you go up, get your teeth brushed, and then I'll read you a story. But he had corrupted again by then, and the apples fell one by one to bruise on the hardwood floor. His eyes stared, slightly out of kilter, at my dusty bookshelf, his fingers struggling at a button on his shirt. I reached forward and wiped away the thin dribble of saliva that ran from the bad corner of his mouth. Come on, little guy, I said, and hoisted him up. As I carried him upstairs into the darkness, his head lolling against my shoulder, I wondered how much had changed, whether in 9 months the crash would still come as we drove back from a happy evening in Gainesville. And I wondered, if it did, whether I would do anything to avoid it, or if I would steer the car even harder this time. It's a little afterward by Goblin Hood here. I actually have quite a bit to say about this story. Presumably this side of the tape is almost over. I've only got something short that goes on the other side, and then I'm going to talk about both of them, I guess, for once. I really do want to talk a little bit. But for right now, I'll just read what it says about this story in the introduction from the Best New Horror Anthology. Save As came into being from the collision of 2 thoughts, recalls Smith. One concerned the way in which we're prepared to put our trust in computers, despite the fact that we struggle with their inadequacies every day. The second was that, actually, when compared to fate, computers are relatively trustworthy. In a perfect world, we would be able to take some of the metaphors of computing and put them to use in our real lives. This is not, however, anything like a perfect world. Okay, Goblin Hood again. I'm actually hoping this side of the tape is almost over. Because I feel as if I'm sort of wasting tape here. I could have gotten more on this tape than just this story and one very short one. The other one is about 4 pages long. But I'm kind of trying to stick to categories of tales. And most of the stories I've got are either too long. I mean, like, I'm surprised this one fit on one side of a tape. I thought it was a little bit longer than that. But almost everything I've got, unless I read really fast, would probably run past the end of the other side, so I'm just going to stick with the thing I planned. Like I said, I've actually got some thoughts I'd like to record about both of the stories on here. This one in particular, this Save As, it's a an oddball story, and it has certain strengths and certain weaknesses. I'm actually kind of surprised I wound up taping it, but of the stories in that particular anthology, it's stuck with me more than most of them. And it has a Dickian, Philip K. Dickian quality that kind of appeals to me in a certain way. So I'll probably be talking about that more at the end of the tape. Right at the moment, I'll just say as well that it provided me an excellent opportunity to do a little bit of what I was about to say just there at the end of the other side was that I got to do some interpretive narration with the story Save As, about the Same Again Corporation. But I'll go into all of that in greater detail after this next very short story that follows. In a way, these two stories have certain things in common, and among them, the fact that I guess they would both be classified as science fiction. And they're both, in a way, about ghosts. But again, I'll get into that when this story's done. This next story is being read from the anthology 100 Ghastly Ghost Stories, selected by Stefan Zamianowicz, Robert Weinberg, and Martin H. Greenberg, published by Barnes & Noble Books, and copyright 1993. The story is entitled simply Ghost Story, copyright 1977 by Alan Brennert, and it was first published in Future Pastimes, which I guess is an anthology or a collection. So here it is. Ghost Story by Alan Brennert. That's B-R-E-N-N-E-R-T. Ghost Story by Alan Brennert. Read by Goblin Hood. Dusk devils come spinning up from behind the swollen horizon, all blood and scabs in the sunset glow. Pinwheeling into the gray shadows at our feet, we catch them down there, tugging, scratching, kicking themselves into our path, trying to make us trip and fall. And they hide in the ground, in the rocks, in the new dust and the old. Nuisances, nothing more than that. Scratchy, scrawny annoyances that chatter and chuckle at our feet. Dusk devils. Dusk deepens to night and the devils drop away, scurry back to meet the sinking sun. Then the real devils start in. Then the sky ghosts flicker and dance on the cloudless black. They're tall, wider than the sun. The moon could be one of their balls turned white and free swung. And they're covered all over. Dim reds, faded greens, colors worn to a whisper by the sky. Only their hands and faces are pasted naked against the night. Even some of their eyes framed by glass and metal. The same six or seven of them,
feet cut off at the horizon, staring down at us, moving their mouths, but damn it, if nothing ever comes out. I watch their lips sometimes, try to read the words, but they're speaking in a distant tongue. I turn away and to hell with it. They're only ghosts. Sky ghosts. Knew a man once looked a lot like them, close enough to be a brother. Same type of face, you know, same kind of build. He was like a ghost himself, but didn't fade with the day. We had to kill him. You get through the night, all right. Sky ghosts above you staring and speaking. You're cold and huddling in group fucks to keep them away. And then there's a sort of almost dawn, gray enough for the dusk devils to come back and scuttle round at naked thighs and cold, flat bottoms. Day comes quicker than night, though, and they run back to the edge of the world to wait out the sun. They've got time. Time. Wondered how it worked once. 1 minute, 1 moment, you're here, and the next you're there. What happened to here? Is it gone, or what? Tried to stand still between seconds, but I couldn't. I just kept moving. Everything's moving. Mornings, the hunt for food, the scrambling that puts the devils to shame. Mornings, the rush for shrubs and piss holes. If you don't do it private, there's a stink on the land nobody wants. Mornings, the first moment of day and the start of the long, slow slide down to night. Mornings moving. Moving's something to do while you die. It's the laughter, mind you. It's the giggling and cackling you hear from beneath the earth. That's what hurts. Beneath the earth, that's where they're buried. Those dead ones who do the job the ghosts and devils do, but do it best.
Fine day,
they'll say.
Look at the sky.
A buried chuckle.
Look at that sky.
Goes on like that, laughter in the earth. Our parents' laughter, damn them, laughing at us for being so stupid. So we move. We run over the parched desert through the ruins of a yester town. We search for food and try not to hear the laughter. Some of us, we run fast enough, we die from the effort. We're not all that strong. That calls for a celebration, then. That calls for running and yelling and day-fucking. That calls for a lot. Goes like this. Someone falls. Usually he's been chasing something across the plains. He keels over and lies flat on the ground. Where he's lying, there's no laughter for a while, as if the dead ones don't know what to make of this yet. Then suddenly it starts up again, weaker. They've lost another victim, but they've got to keep laughing. We'll gather round and stare at the body a few seconds, and then somebody will start laughing right in with those bastards down there. And it started. The food of the morning is wolfed down, and then we try some games before the bodies got too stiff to stand a good breath. prick, and then we'll start some stories going. Maybe about the dead man, maybe not. Stories are my specialty. You know that, listening. I make a few up. Hear secondhand of some. Pass others along. Once I told how I visited a cave in the Bleeding Valley near the horizon where the sky ghosts stand. Saw metal inside, dabbed red by the sun. Heard the clack of the dead one's metal soles on the hard iron floor of the earth's belly. Apart from the machines, the cave is hollow. Some say that's where the sky ghosts go during the day. Maybe so. Maybe that's why some call the ghosts by other names, like holograms. Maybe so. Stories help fill the days when most of the time there's nothing to do but shrug off the heat or the cold and sit on the torn ground while the dead ones poke and point at the sky. They always did that even when they weren't dead.
The sky, look at the sky. We used to touch it.
I'll tell you something, and I don't care who hears it. I'm sick of the sky, and I hate it. And I say, fuck it. Fuck the whole blue, white, hot, cold sky.
Fine day.
One of my stories never caught on is the one about people who used to make things in their heads, waking dreams they tried to build and sometimes did. Most everyone laughs at that, says, no one can build, it isn't done. Then I say that these people didn't always build right. Sometimes they made nightmares for themselves because they couldn't dream anything else. And then they built those too, only they weren't real, just dreams that only they could see. Everyone turns away at this and won't speak to me for the longest while. And I'm sorry I said it, and please don't you turn away. No. Something else. Something else. Afternoons are play times. Times you go exploring. Walk three steps past where you walked yesterday. Or hurl a rock over a hill and wait to hear a noise. It's getting harder to play every day, though. The rocks bite and the ground turns to mud as you walk, getting harder to do anything more than sweat or shiver. Knew a woman once got it into her head that the dead flew over the burnt hills to another world. Damned if she didn't go trotting over there after her dead brother. She never came back, but at least she went. I loved her for that. No one goes over the hill anymore. The sun's got too old to light our way, I guess. Times it looks as dead as the rest of us. That's what the dead ones told us before they were dead. It's the color of blood because it's bleeding, and one day soon, the last drop will be drawn and will all of us die.
The sky.
Then there's the story that boils up off the dried earth every night as the dusk devils scamper and scream around us, and the sky ghosts flicker into life above. The words come scattered from every voice, from childhood tales and wandering travelers. Words torn and brittle with time about what the sky ghosts are saying. Nothing that ever makes any sense.
Your men.
Someone remembers their grandfather telling them as a child.
Your minds.
Whispers a woman who'd once lain with an old man and watched him die in her. Her eyes are glassy with the memory ever since.
Think, please think.
Begs a beggar, the plea handed down from beggar father to beggar son. Other words, other pleas. Son, die. Leave you, sorry, star, sky. No one knows how long they've been up there. Every generation's seen them, and there's never any argument over particulars. Never anyone who claims they're not there. Not like with the dusk devils. Everyone sees the same thing. Clear as the night they're hung on. Someone says, they're tombstones. Someone asks, for who? Leave you, die.
Your minds.
Star. Ship. We get hot and tired of the words. Tired of trying to remember, trying to think. They all want us to think, and it's getting so goddamned hard. Maybe we aren't as smart as our fathers or their fathers before them. Maybe we aren't right, but we try. I start to tell a story then to break up the sadness, to bring everyone into better spirits, and start the laughing and singing and fucking. I start talking, and my voice is sky cool and very quiet, and before I know it, I'm telling them about the people who make things up in their minds and live their nightmares and can't ever break out. And as I brush away a dusk devil, I see they're all turning and frowning and staring at the sky. Just like you, damn it. Just like you. Okay, the business end of this tape is finished, and the rest is just commentary by Goblin Hood, so I can kind of relax and suck on a cough drop, smoke them if I got them kind of deal. I've actually been waiting for days to tape this. I tend to be kind of superstitious about things. But, well, let's see. For a few days I was too tired. I haven't been sleeping at night. I have been sleeping at night, and that's actually when I do these tapes the best. And then I didn't want to do it on Wednesday because it was the 13th. Didn't want to do it on Thursday because it was Thursday. And also, it was Valentine's Day and I had other preoccupations. But I did want to get it done. It was only that first story, Save As, that's what I'm kind of superstitious about, just because of what the story is about.
That's the one that I've got the most to say, to talk about here. But in terms of this ghost story, I'd like to say that it's kind of neat. It's very evocative. It's a typical class of story. Kind of like ruined future dystopian science fiction mixed with horror. It's evocative for all kinds of reasons, and one of the things that makes it a neat story is that it's all told in this confused way by a narrator who doesn't understand what he's talking about. And he blurts out bits and pieces of it without any comprehension that give clues which suggest things. They suggest that part of the human race has just split in a starship before the sun started to die. And for the benefit of people left behind, they left this record. The Dusk Devils, don't know what that would be, unless it's like some phenomenon caused by climate changes. By the way, the word is Dusk Devils. They come out during the dusk, but it suggests the idea of little dust devils too, maybe little whirlwind things, or maybe just some kind of animal that creeps out at night. The sky ghosts are the interesting thing here. The other ghosts, the dead ones in the ground that he talks about, sound as if they could be some sort of a audio recording that has been left on or, you know, malfunctioned so that it's always going and yammering. The sky ghosts sound like gigantic holograms, which the story, in fact, suggests that that's exactly what they are, and that they're, you know, just projected up there. Maybe they're there all the time and you can only see them in the dark. But, they would be like perhaps some monument to the people that left the planet, some sort of an explanation going on. Like I said, it's all very evocative. You can make a lot out of it without really putting your finger on anything. Clearly, I love the idea of gigantic holograms as big as the sky. And I've, like, done some writing in a similar vein. Right now, all of my own best holograms are sitting on top of the bookshelf. And I've got arranged a bunch of little, you know, figurines and things that I picked up from here and there. We set it up as a kind of a nativity scene for Christmas. There's a Christmas tree at one end, but at the other are these holograms in the background of like these little three-dimensional images walking around or standing or whatever, or crawling. All different kinds, soldiers, Indians, cowboys, you know, warriors, mostly from different periods, plus cartoon characters, Superman, Godzilla, and a few even less realistic things, just standing there with the holograms in the background, very similar to this. Just yesterday for Valentine's Day, Julia got me a brand new hologram that we found out at Myers. It's a commemorative plaque for a dead racing car driver named Dale Earnhardt, who I think was actually killed in the line of his work, you know, driving his car. It's a really nice hologram, I mean, compared to anything else you'd find around here, and it's nicely presented on a little plaque and everything. It's got a title, Out of This World, and it shows the race car driver, Dale Earnhardt, standing in the foreground, and in the background is a section of Earth seen from space. There's stars behind that, and his race car is like blasting off into space. It's really a beautiful little setup, however cheesy. I mention it now because it reminds me more of this story than anything else. Like, and it's funny because the holographic theory of reality that I've been subscribing to for the past year suggests that ghosts, if they're real, are a kind of hologram. Well, it suggests that everything is, but they're just a different aspect of it. And so what's left of Dale Earnhardt is this hologram, plus a lot of flat images, plus a lot of hype and hoopla and so forth. Generally, I'm not interested in sports, and definitely not interested in race car driving, but I am interested in holograms, and this one, you know, despite its subject matter, turns out to be a really good one. And it reminds me of this story, this gigantic Earnhardt looming over the Earth after he's already gone. There's also a picture of the Orion constellation, rendered as a Greek god with a shield and a club. And he's hanging in the sky, in a starry sky over a pastoral little landscape. That was from a collection of night sky holograms Julia got me a couple of Valentine's days ago. And there's like a dinosaur, there's a planet, there's other images, including one from Star Trek, the spaceship Enterprise, flying around. Like I said, all of these turn out to make a surprisingly neat backdrop for the little toy crowd scene in front. I just mention this because, in a way, it's like evocative, the same way that Brainerd's story was. I want to go on to the story Save As. As I see it, it's got a couple of flaws and some really strong points. And the fact that it's so confusing and non-specific is one of the strong points, so in a sense the flaws don't really matter. First of all, there's the question of what exactly is really happening up to the point where the narrator goes to the Same Again Corporation warehouse. It's pretty straightforward. At that point, he seems to be simply sitting in a chair, experiencing the rest of the story as a kind of a hallucination induced by drugs and some sort of virtual reality setup. So, to that extent, yeah, they would need a lot of room, even though he says the data storage wouldn't take up much if they've got a bunch of people sitting around experiencing their past lives this way. It would be sort of like a warehouse for zombies. It doesn't say how long it goes on. Does he just sit there for days or years or what? In that sense, it gets kind of nonspecific. It's very similar in tone to the movie total recall, which is why I said it had a Philip K. Dickian quality to it. Because there a guy goes and sits in a chair and gets loaded up with drugs and, you know, basically brainwashed into thinking he's gone to Mars. And from that point on, you're left to wonder if anything that happens after that is real or if it's all just this fake memory experience he's going through. And if so, where is he? Is he still in the chair? Is he out walking around thinking all this stuff? The Smith story, save as, it suggests that there's something physical happening, but it doesn't really go into the details. When it talks toward the end about the illegality of it, and criminals would use it to almost go back in time, politicians would use it to experiment, it's difficult to figure out how that could actually work. One thing is, it almost suggests that everybody's experience is just the equivalent of this computer program running, you know, and like when you don't like the way it goes, you go back and start over again from another point. But the story seems more hard-edged than that. Here's the part that fascinates me. Right at the end, it seems clear that the data has been corrupted and that this perfect little life the guy is remembering has suddenly started turning into some sort of a dreary living hell. And yet, the living hell is so well realized that it seems almost more real than the memories he was trying to re-experience. And every time I read the story, I've had to ask myself how much of what he was recording to begin with was real. Did he ever have this perfect family, perfect life situation? Or was it closer to the version where his wife doesn't like him and he's addicted to cocaine and his son is like brain damaged or something? Or is it somewhere in the middle, the very end, where he asks, he speculates about whether the next time the crash comes, he would spin the wheel even harder, creates a suggestion that maybe he just couldn't take his life anymore, and he ended it with the car crash, killing the people that he wasn't getting along with, and then goes back to re-experience this fake, perfect life with them that he had recorded in the past. Somehow that doesn't seem like the answer either, but it seems as if it could be. It seems as if what's going on there is too confused to really figure out what the actual reality is. It's one of the things I like about it, is this ambiguous quality. Again, it has a lot in common with Philip K. Dick. Particularly the scene in the story where he's experiencing this unreal experience. You know, he's like sitting in his unreal home, consulting his unreal computer, and there's like an unreal number that he's supposed to call if he's having any problems, and he can't get a hold of them. He thinks maybe they've gone out of business. Well, we know they haven't, but it's like at that moment, it's very Dickian, and he's like in a completely unreal world, trying to make contact with whatever the reality is. and slowly remembering things like the guy with the towel and the water damage to the data. But again, my question is, how much damage was there actually? How much of it is like this jolly, well, we have such a wonderful life here, me and my family and my home and my boss. How much of that was real? Did he just, like, record himself believing all that? It suggests that that was real, that he went that particular day to make the recording because things were going so well that day. But it could have been just the mood he was in, figuring this is probably as good as it's gonna get. At least today I could go in there and be positive about things. And that maybe when the people around him become corrupted, as he puts it, maybe all that's happening is his real memories are filtering through the way things really were. You know, it calls into question the nature of reality itself. I mean, as all such stories do, but it's also like, for the reader, trying to pick through this, trying to figure out what the reality is, what's going on in fact. One is left to wonder and to try and figure out what they find easier to believe. Is it easier to believe this happy-go-lucky life where the kids are all having fun and everybody's sitting around happily drinking and nobody's got any problems? Is that easier to believe, or is it easier to believe that nothing is ever that good and that there are problems? The wife is always making it with the boss, and the narrator himself tried to put the moves on the woman that's got cancer or whatever, and the kids are simply vamping on his son because his son is an easy victim. And he's addicted to cocaine because his life sucks. To believe that requires almost that you assume, take for granted, that life itself naturally sucks. Nothing can be as good as this guy was remembering it. Why would you go to the same again corporation and record a life like the one his corrupted version seemed like? Wouldn't it be more reasonable to go there and record what you wanted to believe? And isn't that why the whole thing would be illegal to begin with, is that everybody would be living in this dream world, you know, thinking what they wanted to think, until the water damage came along and either corrupted the data, so to speak, as he thinks, or simply started glitching it out so that you're not remembering what you recorded anymore, you're remembering what was really there. I like the story because it doesn't answer any of this. It forces you to think about it. Like I said, the flaw in the story is that it doesn't even make it clear exactly what the guy is doing, but that could be a strength. In a way, that part isn't important. The important questions are the other ones. There's enough information there suggested that you can just imagine somebody, like I said, sitting in a chair being fed these memories. From there, what the story does is what's important, and as I said, it gives a good opportunity to do a little creative narration. trying to create dramatic tension between his optimistic memories and the corrupted version, which seems so much more realistic. Apart from the whole thing being one more example of some kind of virtual reality gimmick, my favorite sequence in this story was very brief and had very little to do with the story. It was the idea of, like, films being parallaxed. It suggests some technology in the future where an ordinary Tom Hanks movie of today would be parallaxed, whatever that means. Evidently another print of it from some 45 degree angle or something, imposed over it in such a way that it creates some sort of three-dimensional effect. In other words, 3D television in some nebulous future that he's talking about. Even that, hell, I mean, how do we know that that's real? You know, how do we know that that isn't just some snappy little detail he decided to throw into his false memories? But it's interesting, because it's interesting to try to figure out how that would work or what that would look like. Again, it reminds me of the trip to Frankenmuth and Riva's holograms, and how she had one there that reminded me strongly of what they're talking about to some extent, because it may be that this is exactly what they would have had to come up with. It was a picture of, it was a moving picture, a brief newsreel clip of the shooting of Lee Harvey Oswald. It was on a curved surface, like the first hologram I ever saw. And it was wildly distorted as Ruby moves toward the group. No, as, yeah, Jack Ruby moves toward the group of people holding Oswald prisoner. He looms into the foreground gigantically, and they're very small in the background. As he moves toward them, they, you know, their relative sizes become less distinct from one another. But during the beginning of the sequence, as he's like in the foreground, they're in the background, it looks extremely unnatural. Now, I have no reason to believe that there was a holographic photography setup in the basement of the Dallas Police Department or wherever that was that Oswald was shot by Jack Ruby. In other words, there wasn't somebody with a hologram camera standing there taking this picture. So this hologram that they created out of it had to have been, I guess, parallaxed would be the term. Somehow they took the ordinary flat newsreel and rendered it into three dimensions and made a hologram of it. But because it was flat to begin with, the characters don't have a lot of depth. They don't have a lot of volume. They look like flat images shown in different sizes. That's the downside of it. And it's a good example of why, even if it was inexpensive to do, this kind of 3D television probably wouldn't go over because it's so distorted. But sure enough, I mean, it's just like watching the newsreel of Oswald's assassination, only in a kind of three dimensions, where there seems to be space between the characters anyway, but it's at the expense of the thing looking in any way realistic. Still, you don't have to have glasses on to see it or anything. It's just there. And you could watch it on a television if the television was equipped to create that same kind of illusion of space. But it's not the same as, like, a real hologram. With this Dale Earnhardt hologram I mentioned, it doesn't have the same problem because it isn't doing the same kind of thing. It's even more faked. You know, he was never standing in front of the planet like this with his car in the background shooting out into space. But that's the whole point. He looks fairly real in the foreground. The stuff in the background looks as real as it has to be to look like what it's supposed to be, but it doesn't have to create a realistic environment. It creates a very nice environment to look at. It's very deep and three-dimensional, beautifully rendered. But it's not like taking an actual scene apart and faking it into some kind of depth. It's like creating depth in a scene that's fake to begin with, which